Security Ledger podcasts reach an audience of thousands of information technology and information security professionals. If that's an audience that you'd like to reach, think about becoming a Security Ledger podcast sponsor. To find out more about sponsoring our podcast, point your web browser to securityledger.com/sales. Hello, this is the Security Ledger Podcast, and I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode of the podcast, number 170.
Taddeo had the full backing of the DCCC, but her campaign was upended 2 weeks before the primary.
Not only were we hacked, but our information is now public, from our polling to the entire path to victory.
It's your game plan.
Yes.
Cyber attacks on high-profile political campaigns weren't limited to the now infamous 2016 presidential election in the United States. In fact, hacks on campaigns have now become more the rule than the exception, with evidence of campaign hacking and damaging leaks in the U.S. midterms, as well as in the lead-up to this week's parliamentary elections in the United Kingdom. There are many explanations for why. Campaigns operate almost entirely online these days, making the crowbar and flashlight routine of the Watergate burglars unnecessary. But campaigns are also slapdash affairs, spun up quickly with an ever-evolving and revolving staff, and spun down just as quickly after the voting is finished. Furthermore, campaigns run on shoestring budgets, with most of their available cash devoted to getting their candidates' message out to voters. Cybersecurity tools and talent are not a high priority. No matter. In the wake of the 2016 election hacking, plenty of cybersecurity firms stood ready to offer both tools and talent for free. But then there's the matter of federal election rules in the United States, which consider such discounts as in-kind gifts that are not allowed under existing campaign finance rules. Enter Defending Digital Campaigns, a not-for-profit group that was created to give campaigns access to cybersecurity products, services, and information regardless of party affiliation. The group includes political heavy hitters, including the former presidential campaign managers for both Hillary Clinton and Mitt Romney, as well as former senior officials at the National Security Agency, the Department of Homeland Security, and tech industry luminaries. Critically, Defending Digital Campaigns has something no single cybersecurity firm does: Federal Election Commission permission to provide discounted cybersecurity services to federal candidate committees and national party committees. With the Iowa caucuses just months away and the race for the presidency heating up in the United States, we invited Michael Kaiser, the president and CEO of Defending Digital Campaigns, into the Security Ledger studios to talk with us about the group. Joining him in the studio is Joel Wallenstrom, the CEO of secure messaging and collaboration platform Wickr, which is offering its technology to campaigns through the Defending Digital Campaigns group. To start off, I asked Michael and Joel to talk about what they see the purpose of Defending Digital Campaigns to be and how they got involved with the organization.
I'm Michael Kaiser. I'm the president and CEO of Defending Digital Campaigns, and we're a new nonprofit, a 501c4 that was established to help bring cybersecurity, better cybersecurity practices to federal campaigns. That would be House, Senate, and presidential campaigns, as well as the national parties and committees, working with industry partners and in the campaign ecosystem to increase the use of cybersecurity services. But what makes us unique is that our founders went out to the Federal Election Commission and got approval for us to negotiate with companies to bring free or low-cost services into campaigns to try and address the issue that campaigns may or may not be willing to spend money on cybersecurity, yet they all need it. So we're very excited about the prospects in the 2020 cycle upcoming. And there's going to be a lot of campaigns that are going to need help, and we know that they're going to be targets of attack.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Joel Wallenstrom. I'm the CEO of a company called Wickr. We have a secure collaboration product, very much like Slack, but with a lot of data security principles built into it. I've been doing computer security for 20 years. And one of the first things we did here at Wickr is on the back end of 2016, we leaned in and did everything we possibly could to help campaigns, but we ran into a lot of red tape and a lot of disinformation in the kind of the procurement process. And so we're just absolutely tickled to be working with DDC because, you know, it's just having a partner who paves the way and makes sure that we're able to act fast on behalf of, well, really democracy. It's just, it's a great addition to the ecosystem.
Defending Digital Campaigns, just talk a little bit about the origins of the group and what prompted you to create this foundation? What was the sort of organizing idea behind it?
Back after the 2016 campaign, there was a group of people at the Belfer Center at Harvard that looked at some campaign cybersecurity issues, including the infrastructure issue, but also campaigns, right? And they got together and they made a playbook. They have a cybersecurity playbook for campaigns. And some of the folks that were on that effort, who are my founding board members, Robbie Mook, who was Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, Matt Rhodes, who was Mitt Romney's campaign manager, and Deborah Plunkett, who's a former information security assurance at the NSA, realized as they were going through that process that what they were recommending to campaigns was that they should have products, right? That they should be implementing cybersecurity products. There's a very rich and robust right, cybersecurity product community now. There's a lot of things that campaigns could be implementing that would make them safer. Campaigns are obviously very much at risk. We could talk about that at some point. But what they realized was that, you know, with that campaign experience that they had, that campaigns weren't necessarily going to make those investments. And there needed to be a way to overcome the fact that companies aren't just allowed to donate to campaigns. There are limits. There are issues around corporate donations. And so they came up with the notion of Defending Digital Campaigns to be the nonprofit third-party intermediary between the campaigns and the industry. And they formed DDC. This was long before I was hired. And they created the organization. And then they went to the Federal Election Commission. And they proposed to them this notion of this nonpartisan, non-aligned organization that would work equally with any eligible campaign and would try to encourage companies to participate and encourage campaigns to bring these services into their campaign environment. And that's really the notion, right? That there should be ways, very easy ways, low friction ways for campaigns, which are, you know, different than other kinds of enterprises to get cybersecurity quickly and in place to protect themselves.
Yeah. And Joel, you mentioned the sort of regulatory hurdles that you encountered there at Wikr. How did you initially envision Wikr kind of helping campaigns? And what were some of the obstacles that you ran into?
Initially, when 2016 happened, a lot of people jumped on to, well, realistically, they got their solutions from the App Store. They use consumer products. And in some of the after action reporting, the campaign world, the election world said, this is not good enough for us. We need to be able to have the ability to manage these products. And we built a product that is CEO proof. And so because we can deploy it and make it easy enough for a CEO to use, we, you know, we all saw that this was easy enough for a candidate or a campaign manager to use. So we thought we had a really good fit. And then we said, what we want to do is just let people use it and either give really reduced pricing or give it away for free. And the response was, you can't do that. And we got really kind of pulled into a longer and more complex process working with lawyers to come up with contracts that would work on both sides of the aisle. And, you know, we put as much energy into building out the legal framework for actually giving something to these campaigns that could help them as we did building the product. And I think that's a, you know, that's not what we want Silicon Valley to be doing. We want to be innovating. We don't want to be, you know, like running into brick walls when we're trying to help. And so this is what's been refreshing about it because, you know, we can stick with building the product and giving good customer service and not trying to figure out exactly how we, you know, negotiate our way through legal processes.
I know this sort of made news, you know, 6 or 8 months ago where you had this amazing spectacle of the Federal Election Commission basically saying to cybersecurity companies that wanted to help these campaigns, no, that's not allowed. You're not allowed to. What was behind that? I mean, what are the specific FEC election rules that prohibit those types of in-kind donations? And obviously that generated this huge kind of controversy. What came out of that?
You know, I'm not a lawyer or a Federal Election Commission expert, and I think, you know, Joel may have some to add to this, but there are...
That doesn't stop anybody these days, pal. Just give us your opinion. Sling it.
It does stop me. I believe in, you know, being honest about what I know and really honest about what I don't know. I think, you know, there are just general limits, right, of any contribution by anyone to any campaign. And so I think there's that step one, right? That, you know, you can't just give as much as you want to a campaign, whatever, you know, the $2,800 limit is, you know, applies, you know, across the board. I think also there was probably some concern about equity, right? Would some, you know, group of campaigns end up with more cybersecurity than others? How do you create, you know, equal access, right? So that whatever deals are being offered, they're available to everyone. Not just, you know, somebody comes along and says, you know, we want to support, you know, the Acme Party. And so we're going to give it to them for free. But if the Acme International Party comes, we're going to charge them double. Right. So I think people wanted to avoid those kinds, not only of appearances, but of reality. Right. If the concern, and I think this is what the FEC said in our opinion, was if this is such a national emergency, which it is, then it should be for all comers, and we should be working to bring this to everyone. And I think that was really, I think, a really important underlying factor in this. But I think there are legal issues around monetary donations, how much people can give, you know, what corporations can give, and those kinds of things. And so this was a way of getting a special dispensation to, you know, let's break through all of that and let's get the cybersecurity into campaigns' hands.
So I have a perspective on that as well. And that is one of the things that really amazed me prior to 2016 is, you know, having been in the computer security world for decades, you know, we would oftentimes reach out to campaigns and having maybe looked at their websites to see that they were not maybe professionally built and managed and offer help. And usually we would get no response. And I never fully had an appreciation for why, but then, you know, Robbie was one person who said, "You can't believe it. We get 200, you know, messages a day offering help, and 100 of them are nefarious." And, you know, it was very hard for them to kind of cut through that noise. So I didn't have an appreciation for that. And then, realistically, as Michael was talking about some of the FEC guidelines, from a technology company's perspective, about 20% of the way through the explanation from a lawyer on FEC guidelines, I think there's a lot of eye rolling saying like, look, we're just going to go back to building our product.
Could we talk, maybe just roll back the tape a little bit to 2016, some of what we know happened in that campaign, both at the top of the ticket and even down in, you know, Senate and House races. If we were to sort of bring up the list of the most important vulnerabilities that campaigns have to cyber attack or compromise, what are they generally?
If you start and just look at a campaign like you look at any enterprise, right, they're going to be vulnerable just like any enterprise to some of the most basic cybersecurity risks, right? We know, for example, that phishing emails were a prominent feature in 2016 as one of the vectors of attack. And email remains a very strong vector of attack, not only to campaigns, but to enterprises across the world. You know, that basic hygiene of preventing people from clicking on phishing links or from phishing emails even getting in your system, obviously, you know, one of the basic vulnerabilities. I think the other, of course, is people. So making sure that they are using the tools that are given to them to make sure that they're doing the most that they can in their daily work online or on their computers to prevent the escape of information. But I think in terms of vulnerabilities, you know, what we see, of course, is that campaigns are not the same as regular enterprises for all different kinds of reasons. First and foremost, the work that they're doing makes them vulnerable to nation states, makes them vulnerable to hacktivists who don't like what they're saying. It could even make them vulnerable to cyber criminals who think, well, okay, these people must have lists of high wealth individuals. They must have credit card numbers. They must have all kinds of data that could be of interest or monetized. What also makes them vulnerable, I think, and this is, you know, some of what I think we saw actually in 2016, is that campaigns are not hard perimeter operations. First of all, it's 99.999% BYOD, right? Bring your own device. So people are coming into these campaigns, not only with their own devices, but they're coming in with their own email addresses, right? If they're not using a campaign domain, they're using, you know, their home Wi-Fi, they're using all different kinds of distributed technologies, which in the corporate world, might be under a hood, right? You know, that somebody's looking after. So I think, you know, those are the kind of vulnerabilities that we think about, and that campaigns grow very quickly, shrink very quickly, and aren't around for a long time period. So it's not, doesn't make sense for them to be thinking in the long term the way a traditional enterprise might evolve a security approach.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's what's so amazing to me is how the relationship between a campaign and an enterprise is kind of like the pop-up Halloween shop to, you know, I don't know, like Macy's or Neiman Marcus or something. You know, it's like they're there and then November 1st, they're just shut down.
Even the successful ones shut down, right?
Yep.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And when I first sat down with some campaign management officials, I guess, in 2016 and just listened, and I heard about how they built their organization and the time frame and the percentage of volunteers and how distributed, and to Michael's point, everything was BYOD. You know, I've worked with a lot of startups and large enterprises to build out security teams and organizations, and there are very few that grow that fast, that distributed. And so you have this, it's very much like, you know, a rocket ship startup that has to, you know, burst really fast in their operations. And they just so happens that day one, you know, nation states are their adversary very clearly. And that's not the case. I mean, if you're typically, if you're building a product company or something in Silicon Valley, you get to do this bursting, but you don't have to fight the biggest fight that exists in computer.
Right.
You know? And so, so, you know, that just, I think that gives all of us, when we get a chance, you know, this, the computer security world can be kind of finger pointing, but I think when people step back and take a look and understand that dynamic, it's pretty interesting, and it's a very hard thing to secure. I think the other thing that I came up against that was really fascinating is that, you know, this might be like securing an enterprise, but then there's this, and you know, Michael talked about email is tough, and that is a that is going to continue to be a tough thing for campaigns. Things like secure transferring of polling data and, you know, donor information, that sort of stuff is really difficult. But that's kind of the blocking and tackling of security operations. There's also the disinformation thing in 2016. So, you know, if somebody goes out and tries to manipulate the stock market through false public relations, there's a corrective tool that exists in our economy to really deal with that. Maybe not exactly in the moment, but certainly, you know, you don't see that as a spectacularly successful path for fraud. You know, when we do this in elections, it really only has to happen right at the very end, right? When people are voting, do you do this disinformation? And we, you know, there aren't too many mechanisms that exist out there in computers, quote unquote, right now to deal with that in such a timely fashion. So, you know, it's a tough space. It's gone beyond, you know, just having a secure website for the campaign. It's a really complex thing for the overall infrastructure that DHS and others have to deal with. And then each individual campaign has to do their own, you know, smart operational security blocking and tackling.
If a campaign is out there and listening and they are interested in this, what are some of the services that you provide?
Yeah, so we have a group of services now, and we'll be growing it, I think, substantially in the short term. But you know, we have kind of a broad based approach. We have some email security services, like we discussed. We obviously have Wicker, which provides that secure communications, which I think actually is really important for campaigns to be able to talk to themselves or between themselves and others, and keep those things private and secure. I think that's a very important part of how campaigns operate. We've got some training that we've for folks. We've got some mobile security We have a, you know, really working on a whole host of different kinds of services. We'll hope to be announcing shortly some other service providers that are coming in, you know, looking at issues like multi-factor authentication, and, you know, website security and some other areas that we think are kind of essentials, essential basics really for every campaign. Trying to scale, we have managed services, which is, you know, a way for campaigns to get some help monitoring their networks without having to have, you know, someone who's a security expert on board 24 hours a day. So we're trying to looking for things that make it easy for campaigns, not only easy on the security side, but, you know, we really want to have really the least amount of friction between, like, I want to do this to getting it done. So, you know, speed is of the essence working with these folks. So we'll be looking at, you know, a pretty broad base of services, but we also have to scale to, you know, the very small campaigns, right? Which, you know, many of the congressional campaigns are 10 or less, up to thinking about presidentials, which could be several thousand at the end of the cycle. So it's a pretty diverse ecosystem that we have to deal with.
What are some of the threats or attacks that we're seeing either from the 2018 midterm cycle or even early now in the 2020 presidential cycle? You mentioned, you know, phishing attacks seem maybe more financially motivated, but what are some of the things that campaigns are coming up against?
Yeah, I don't think phishing is necessarily all it has. I mean, I think in the world, it's typically been financially motivated. And even in campaigns, we've seen that. But remember, that's just simply, I'm going to give you credentials to get access to something. And that might be banking information. It might be donor lists. It might be, you know, looking at the strategy around polling data or opposition research.
Yeah.
So, you know, look, when pharmaceuticals are attacked via phishing, sure, sometimes they're trying to get the CFO to send a check somewhere, but it's also a path to getting to IP. So, you know, campaigns need to look at it the same way. I'd say from the information I have and the experience I have outside of what's a very different sort of attack vector, which is this disinformation piece. It's very much getting access to emails, getting access to communications, and getting them so that they either know what the next steps are or so that they can just, like, you know, really grep through all the information for stuff that can be glued together as something that could be released into the public domain.
I would just concur with that. I think, you know, reputational harm is probably the thing that campaigns think about a lot, right? Like, how would this hurt my candidate? How would this hurt our campaign? You know, we don't want this in the news cycle. And I think, you know, to Joel's point, I often say campaigns have IP, right? They have campaign IP. They have intellectual property. You know, even things like drafts of policy positions that they're, you know, trying to hammer out, right? And, you know, maybe all kinds of people are throwing ideas into that, you know, into that hopper as it's getting created. They're not all going to make it on their paper, you know, into the final copy. And you wouldn't want that out beforehand, right? You'd only want out what you want out. And so I think campaigns are really at risk for that in different kinds of ways because of the harm and the impact that that stuff being out can have on a campaign. And the bad folks going after them know that. If you can get a news cycle that harms a campaign, you know, that's a win for someone who's an adversary. So it should not be understated how important that valuable internal information is to be protected.
So one of the things we've been writing about a fair amount here at the Security Ledger is the scourge of ransomware attacks. And increasingly, we're seeing them hit, you know, public sector entities, town governments, city governments, and so on. Is this something that is affecting campaigns as well? And if so, how?
You know, that's a really intriguing question. Something I've been noodling with my friends over the last couple months, because we talked about just the good hygiene that campaigns need around secure communications, two-factor authentication, patching, etc. The attack that is ransomware tends to be opportunistic. So people are out there looking for systems that are prone to this. And certainly some campaigns will be. But I also think that there's a timing aspect around campaigns that's interesting because, you know, to use a industry analog, there will be a Black Friday for campaigns, or there's a time when, you know, this idea of, or this concept of ransomware becomes more relevant. And so, you know, the good thing about it is this is just really good blocking and tackling. Again, campaigns having good backups, being prepared for this. This is a doable thing and a preparable defense. It just needs to be done.
Michael, do you get a sense that this is something that's on the radar for campaign managers, that they may be vulnerable to these types of paralyzing slash crippling ransomware attacks?
You know, I don't think it is to the degree that it should be. I mean, clearly, if you even watch the news in general, you're going to see that ransomware has been a big issue. But I think, you know, it's probably not all that well understood what it actually does and how it might impact a campaign. And I think I'm not a big, you know, believer in fear, uncertainty, and doubt, but I really believe that people should be thinking about ransomware from the perspective of response and recovery, right? What would I do if we got ransomware? How would I respond to that? And then how would I get myself back into operation as soon as possible, given that ransomware attack? If you have a great backup, that's yeah. going to make it all that much faster. But if you don't, you need to be prepared, right, to, you know, switch systems or do other kinds of things or bring in an IT consultant or whatever it is that you're going to need to do to get your campaign back up and rolling. Because the last thing you need is downtime. When you're running a campaign at the last moment.
Yeah, I mean, we think about the October surprise in campaign world as almost always being some damaging piece of evidence or something that's going to come at the last minute and throw your campaign off balance and maybe, you know, stick in voters' minds. But these days, that October surprise very easily could be something like ransomware that simply cripples your campaign.
Yeah, and I think also that campaigns, there can be reputational harm too. Not that I would necessarily blame someone for getting ransomware. It's not always under their control, right? How it happened. I mean, it's not, you know, 100% preventable. But, you know, if your campaign got it and your opponents didn't, and, you know, the media got word of that, they might use that against you.
I do think, at least within, quote unquote, the industry, there is a sort of stigma around ransomware. And, you know, maybe a lot of preventative measures were not in place in a lot of the places where we've seen it be successful. But this speaks back to that leadership point. It's something you can be pretty prepared for. And, you know, to kind of plug the DDC, I would imagine the managed services providers you referenced, Michael, they can probably help a campaign think through these issues. This is one of those things that's really quintessential in computer security. It's something that you can handle and it's something that you can recover from. You just need somebody, you know, in the seat making that decision and making sure that you're taking those steps.
I think these days when we hear about campaign hacks or attacks, everybody's in mind is immediately thinking, oh, it's Russia, or maybe, oh, it's Iran or China, you know, nation state actors. You know, is that a good assumption to make, or is it a more complicated picture than that?
I think it's more complicated, right? I think, first off, I think, you know, nation states will certainly go after candidates, right? I mean, we have living proof of that. We know that that's true, right? But, you know, you look at our environment, it's an adversarial system of winner take all, right? So there could just be, you know, hacktivists who just disagree with a candidate, with a candidate's position, with a candidate's party, who feel like if I could do harm, right, I could help someone else win. I think that's a very strong motivation. And that could be anyone from, you know, right in their community, right, you know, to the, like, I just don't like this person, you know, up to a, you know, to a national level. And then, you know, as I said earlier, the cybercrime, and I think, you know, Joel spoke to this too, you know, if you have information assets that could be monetized in some way, shape, or form, you know, you're going to have cyber criminals that are going to be looking around, and campaigns may have a reputation for being more vulnerable than, say, a bank. And maybe I should go look there for credit card numbers instead of a retailer or some other well-defended, you know, operation.
Yeah, one of the things that did not fill me with optimism is in the last midterm cycle, a lot of, you know, there were a lot of media cycles and press clippings around local election officials making great strides in cybersecurity because they've caught the Chinese port scanning their machines.
And, yeah.
You know, like, those were not great press releases because there was this obvious awareness that they didn't know that had been happening for the last 20 years to everybody on the internet, right? So, you know, my answer would be yes, of course, everyone is going to get some attention from those nation states because that's just what happens when you get onto the internet.
Yeah, I never know what to make of those stories you see of, oh, you know, they were trying to penetrate our network, but we block them, you know, because yes. We've got a firewall or something. And you kind of read that and you're like,
oh, no.
Prior to running DDC, I ran the National Cybersecurity Alliance, and we did a lot of SMB education on cybersecurity. And I think that, you know, I look at these campaigns, especially smaller ones, a lot like SMBs, and could they be a gateway into somebody else, right? If I could get into your campaign, could I get into the state party, right? Because now I'm in your campaign and now I'm contacting the state party or the national party or a committee or, you know, somebody else's campaign. Can I do that out of a campaign that's less protected? Because now I can, you know, maybe get some credentials, look legitimate, send an email up the line, you know, conduct a spear phishing campaign out, you know, inside a campaign. So I think campaigns, it's not only, they have to realize sometimes that it's, they're not only the target to be harmed, but they're the, but they're also could be a gateway into others, you know, and so they need to protect them. Think about how they're protecting, you know, people from moving from their campaign up into the ecosystem as well.
Yeah, I was again mapping some of the 2016 campaigns and looking at their entire third-party ecosystem, and it's pretty vast, whether it's, you know, consulting firms, operation or opposition research firms, polling firms, legal firms, you know, there were a lot of overlapping Venn diagrams, and a lot of this, you know, some of these are like 2-3 person regional shops. And you know, if we think about, and there's been some, I don't know, like calories given in this discussion to how campaigns themselves are maybe behind the eight ball in terms of their technical capability as well. Some of those smaller regional firms are as well, it's, you know, suffice to say. And so, you know, trying to, again, I'm going to go back to decreasing the amount and like just pulling the complexity out of the process as much as possible. Those are the types of things that should be comforting and that we should really lean on when we have the opportunity to.
So that's a final question, which is for campaigns who are listening in, and this is bipartisan, it's both sides of the aisle. It's frankly, people who aren't even on either side of the aisle, right? What can they do to tap into this service and take advantage of your expertise?
Yeah, so they can go to defendcampaigns.org and they can contact us through there. They can look and see the service providers that we have. That's, you know, we have to legitimize you as a campaign that meets our criteria for participation. And just contact us and we'll reach out to them and we'll talk to them and we'll get them a product catalog of everything that we have. And we'll get them thinking about the kinds of things that would make sense for their environment. And we'll get them going and get them set up as soon as we can. And encourage them to think of security not as a one-shot deal coming to us, but as, you know, as we've sort of talked about in this conversation, to, you know, continue to evolve their security as their campaign evolves, and, you know, to build a, you know, a stronger infrastructure around themselves to protect their candidate and their ideas and their campaign.
Yeah, and I want to, you know, you can certainly go to wicker.com to learn more about us or go through DDC to find out more about us, but I want to hit on something you just brought up there. And that is one of the other things, I just want to be transparent here, that we're really excited about beyond just helping democracy is, you know, we feel like we're dealing in an issue around encrypted data and data protection that's really important. So one of the things that we really feel as campaigns use our technology, you know, the whole debate around encryption is going to come to the forefront of their experience, and they're going to use something and they're going to understand the power of, you know, simple, strong technology. And so to a certain extent, we think this is a great platform for people to understand that, you know, the Fourth Amendment's an important thing and protecting data is an important thing. And there are ways to do this the right way and the responsible way. And it's great that we have a partner like DDC to help us, you know, get that platform for people to use our platform.
Yeah, it's a way, it's a great point, which is it's a way to kind of be an object lesson in some ways for these candidates, should they get elected, to engage with this issue of data privacy and data security.
Absolutely. They're elected or not, they're going to be part of the decision-making infrastructure of our country for the next 20 years. And so we need to just give really good, responsible technology to these people and help them understand it, because DC gets ridiculed all the time for not understanding computers, but you know, it's up to us who are in the business of computers to go out and engage and, you know, be a productive member of the conversation, not just sort of a finger pointer.
Sometimes cybersecurity can feel overwhelming to people. Like, you know, we were talking about nation states and we're talking about cyber criminals and hacktivists. And I'm just, you know, someone who's trying to write speeches for my boss, right? Who's out on the trail stumping. And how do I protect all about this? And I think this is to some of what Joel's saying. I think everybody needs to start with just understanding what are the crown jewels of this campaign? What are the things in this campaign that if we lost them tomorrow, or we didn't have access to them tomorrow would really be harmful to us. And start by knowing where those things are and figuring out how to protect them and making sure that you would understand who gets access to them and how would you know if something happened to them. And I think that's just giving people a realistic starting point for getting going. They don't have to boil the entire sea of cybersecurity to be a little bit more secure. And that's where we hope they start.
Michael Kaiser and Joel Wallenstrom, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on Security Ledger Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
As if on cue.
I'm sorry. What's that participant's name?
That is Petey, and it's 5:24, and he wants dinner.
Petey, thank you for coming on Security Ledger Podcast.
No, that was great. That was a great finish, and I really appreciate it. It was a fun conversation.
Thanks, Bye. Guys. Take care. Michael Kaiser is the president and CEO of Defending Digital Campaigns. Joel Wallenstrom is the CEO of the firm Wicker.